Welcome back to The Daily Drum on WHUR and Sirius XM Channel 141. This is the Insight segment. I'm Harold Fisher. Imagine this. You are driving. You see the red and blue lights in your rearview mirror. You're being pulled over by a police officer. As you slow your car down, your heart rate speeds up. You feel the light sheen of perspiration on your skin, and you wonder, what have I done? You are uncertain, you are nervous, you're scared. You ask yourself, what's next? And will you make it home alive? Well, you don't have to imagine that. We're not being overly dramatic here. There are too many high-profile examples in the news right now. And tonight, we take a hard look at this scenario and the broader issues for people of color and their encounters with police. My guests are Johnny Reddick, retired assistant chief with the California Highway Patrol, and Jeff Menzies, doctor of clinical psychology and lead consultant with Mind on the Matter. Lines are open. If you want to comment on this, if you have questions about this, give us a call at 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. You can tweet me at HFisherWHUR or find me on Instagram at Harold T. Fisher. Johnny, thank you so much for joining me. I appreciate it.
Absolutely, Harold. Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. Jeff, good to hear from you again.
Hey, Steve, man. Good to hear from you as well.
Johnny, let me start with you. It is a well-established situation that for many people of color, when they are stopped by police, they are at the very least nervous. But almost all of them are afraid. They're scared. They're terrified. How can a driver, a motorist being pulled over by police prevent their fear from becoming a final life-ending situation for them with police?
You know, Harold, first of all, you know, it's a tragedy that that even has to be a question for you to even ask me. And unfortunately, like you said, this is where we are today in America. And, you know, you talked about the uncertainty and being nervous and being scared. And I will just say that as a mother, as a woman who's been in policing for over 29 years, I've been retired for a few. I don't know that I have a direct answer for the end part of what you said of how to get home alive, because every encounter is going to be something very different. And unfortunately, as we've seen, not everyone does make it home alive. What I would say to your listeners and to your audience, when we're thinking about traffic stops in the context of which that was just phrased, you know, there is conduct in a traffic stop that we all know as citizens whenever we're all pulled over. Even myself being pulled over, even being a police officer, I get the same adrenaline rush, get the same fear. You know, where is my, you know, driver's license? You know, I don't want to do anything too hasty. I still have those thoughts. And it's very different for people of color because that's now amplified, right? And so, you know, what I would say is what, you know, most parents are having a conversation at home. I know I've had it with my son a number of times on the things to do. Follow the rules of the road, pull over to the right, have your information readily available, like your registration, license, unfortunately, hands on the wheel, and be respectful, answer questions. And what I tell my son, to even go a step further, his father and myself were in policing for many years, is to personalize yourself and to say your own name and to also say our names and to let them know you as a human, to humanize yourself. And that's a very sad thing for me to have to say, but that is the kind of conversation that I've had with my son. And you know, I'll pause there because I could go on the kind of conversations then that I would have with my officer.
And I do want to drill down a little bit on that, too. So I definitely want to put a bookmark in that, because that's fascinating. The need or the importance of humanizing yourself is something I honestly have never heard before. And so I do want to talk about that. But Jeff, if you could, talk to me about what is going on beyond my description, my scenario, and the reality of the Dante Wrights and the George Floyds in the media that we all have ingested mentally, emotionally, and how all of that comes to bear when we get in our car and we are pulled over.
Right. I want to thank you, my co-panelists, you know, for your service. I really appreciate you, and especially coming forward in this difficult conversation.
Thank you.
You know, it's really deep, man, because what we're seeing is genuine fear in the motorists, right? When you look at Dante Wright, when you look at the Army lieutenant, this was real fear. You have a brother who is literally trained for war, who is afraid because two police officers have pulled him over. And what you see is a heightened sense of aggression. You almost see what you would find in an animal that has tasted blood and wants its next sample. And that's how I look at this. It's like you have these police officers in these situations, and by no means all officers, have gone over the top. And it seems as almost they have this craving that they're trying to fill. And it's a scary situation, man. Dante didn't stand a chance. When you see him reacting the way that he does, that was not rational response there. That was pure emotion, pure adrenaline, and pure fear, because he thought genuinely that his life was in danger. And guess what? He was correct. He was absolutely correct. George Floyd, he was correct. The fear that he had for those officers, he thought he would lose his life, he was correct. Every one of them who feared for their lives and ended up dying was absolutely correct in their fear when they were first pulled over. That's the part that we continually overlook. They were not wrong. They were not wrong.
202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. We're talking about getting home alive after an encounter with police. What you need to know. If you have a comment, if you have a question, give us a call. Of course, we'll be taking questions all the way up until the 8 o'clock hour. So, Johnny, if we can go back to the humanizing of yourself, and you mentioned, you know, your son, these are the instructions that you've given him and his parents. Walk me through that. What does that sound like once he would be pulled over and has an encounter with police?
Well, first of all, you know, there's this preparation that takes place before he's pulled over, and that's really important. And it's important because my son is 6'5", 250, I don't know, he's huge. And so for him, it's letting him know that your size alone, along with your color, will be intimidating, and you need to understand that. He's a kind young man, but just know that in the context. And this is his father. You know, his father is, you know, a black officer who worked for over 25 or 26 years in one of the most difficult cities dealing with people. But these are the conversations we want to have because we wanted him to come home safe. And also the respectful tone in which you just talk to them. And so it's almost like, yes, we have to create a de-escalation in our children and a respectful response in order to be able to just be able to get some headway. Now, I want to make it clear that I am not speaking for every single individual law enforcement officer who dons a uniform out of the 18,000 police agencies in our United States of America. But we do have police officers who bring their implicit bias, unconscious bias, racism, personal feelings, any of those things that we want to call them to the job every day.
Problems at home. Yeah.
They have cumulative stress and trauma of their own that maybe hasn't been resolved or taken care of. And as you know, we don't teach emotional intelligence enough for them to understand their own self-awareness and self-management. And so you are interacting with these, you know, officers throughout the day. And then some just have poor training tactics. They do poor policing. And so for our son, that's the preparation, is to kind of talk about that. And we always did. And so when you come into an encounter, when you're with your friends and you're in your car, knowing the rules of the road, you took a driving test to know that when a red light comes on, you need to pull over. Don't make it too long. You know, if it's well lit, that's the best, but don't make it too long, because now that's going to create some form of suspicion, because why aren't you pulling over, you know, immediately? And then when they do, understand that if there's two, one's going to come to the right side of the car, another's going to come to the left side of the car. Make sure that your window's already down so you don't have to, you know, worry about them asking you to roll the window down, and then have your hands on the wheel, and then look them in the eye and talk to them when they're asking you the question. Let them know what you're about to do before you move your hands. Make sure that you have somebody, if you have a partner in the car or whoever's riding with you, they know what your rules of engagement are whenever you get pulled over too, for them to not start doing anything. I mean, now people can, you know, use their cell phones and start filming, but you have to be careful, because officers see movement. They don't necessarily see what you're moving to do, and now they consider that furtive. A furtive movement now creates suspicion, may elevate their level of force or how they're going to engage with you. But for him, it would just do those things and, again, identify who you are verbally before they have to even look at your driver's license. And always saying, you know, well, you know, my parents are this or that. And absolutely, I was law enforcement, his father. I was like, you tell them who we are. I don't care. I don't care if I get in trouble for you using my name. I want you to come home.
Okay.
And these are the things that I would share with him. And, you know, he never had a problem where he didn't get home harassed in any way. But he did have an instance at a party where the police came in and they were all young people. And they just treated them just, I don't quite have the words for it, but treated them not like young people that were just having a good time at a party, but almost like they were criminals.
Mm-hmm.
And he shared that with me, and it disheartened me, because here I am, a leader in law enforcement of people that are supposed to go out and be of service, right? And to go to, you know, help, not to harm. And so there was follow-up to that. But anyway,
yeah.
I will take a break there, Harold.
Let me go to the phone lines, 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. We're talking about making it home alive after an encounter with police, what you need to know. Let's talk to Ray, calling from Southeast D.C. Ray, thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Wow. I had a whole different scenario, what was in my brain, but listening to the lady speak and the gentleman speak, it's sad that we are talking about what we as the passenger or the driver should do with a trained police officer that's supposed to be trained in hostile situations, to be in life-threatening situations. But we're talking about telling our children or grown folk, wind down your window, have your ID out, do all these things. But yet, these are trained professionals. So why are we talking to the citizens and not realizing that that police system, that fraternal order of police, all that stuff should be blown up and started all over again? I don't mean literally blown up, but sometimes crank from the man, from the top down, because it's something wrong with that system if we are telling everyday citizens, man, do this, do that, don't do this, do that. And if you still do all that stuff, you still get shot.
Yeah.
So it's something really wrong with that system. We keep talking about it's some good polices, it's some all right polices. If they are good polices, where are they?
Yeah.
Why aren't they telling that their racist partners are racist? Why isn't the captains and the lieutenants pulling those people from the street?
Yeah. Ray, thank you so much for your comments. Real quick, Jeff, you wanted to comment on something.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and I totally understand the sentiment of the caller, but at the same time, we have to be able to protect and, and get ourselves in a codified way of moving, because we know we're dealing with potentially hostile forces. And so, yep, we know that it's a likelihood it could go bad. We do know that. We cannot control that officer directly like that. And so there is absolutely nothing wrong with putting your children on notice, because the goal is for them to survive the encounter. That's, I do a workshop called Surviving the Encounter, and that's what it's all about, getting home. And so it's like if you had a dog on your street, and you know that dog is supposed to be chained up, but you know that dog is also vicious, you are smart and wise to walk past that dog in such a way that it's less likely that you're going to get bit. And yeah. This is the same similar situation. If it's a potential threat, you do everything that you can to master that situation. And that's what I teach my kids. You want to be masterful, just like what our officer is saying. You want to take control of that situation. Assume that this person is scared to death. And I'm with you, brother. As a trained law enforcement officer, if you out there and you scared and you shook, and I understand it could be a scary situation, that means that your training has not been sufficient. Because just like soldiers are desensitized to gunfire, so that every time a gun goes off, they're not startled, we have to have some type of emotionally strengthening training for these police officers so that we can at least remove the excuse that I feared for my life. Right?
I need to take a break, but I want to let our listeners know, Greg from Waldorf, you're next. Also, G, calling from D.C. We're also going to talk to you. Lines are still open at 202-319-7810. 202-319-7810. You can tweet me at HFisherWHUR or find me on Instagram at Harold T. Fisher. Stay with us. The Daily Drum will continue on SiriusXM Channel 141. Don't forget, you can hear every edition of the Daily Drum Insights segment via podcast on WHUR.com after 9 p.m. every night, or download the 96.3 HD2 app on your smartphone and hear the program live in its entirety. I'm Harold Fisher. John Mons is next with the original Quiet Storm on WHUR. This discussion continues on SiriusXM Channel 141 and 96.3 HD2 in just a few seconds. Welcome back to The Daily Drum on SiriusXM Channel 141. I'm Harold Fisher. We are examining encounters with police and people of color. How to make sure you get home alive after an encounter with police. My guests are Johnny Reddick, retired assistant chief of the California Highway Patrol, and Jeff Menzies, doctor of clinical psychology and lead consultant with Mind on the Matter. Lines are still open at 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. If you have difficulty getting in, please keep trying. I promise we will take your phone call. Let's go to Greg calling from Waldorf. Thanks for calling, Greg. What's on your mind?
Pleasure to be with you, Harold. I enjoy your show.
Thank you.
I have an organization, Real Men International and Real Relationships. And more often than not, I hear the reservation in African-American men when we get stopped by the police. I think it's a bigger issue than just policing. It's a racial thing. It's a political thing. When it comes to what's going on now with the Chauvin trial and George Floyd, America would be in an uproar if there was a dog that had their neck choked for 9 minutes. A dog in America would be appalling to this country. And the topic of conversation, Harold, is unique, because these are the conversations that black men have to have with their black sons when our white counterparts do not. They don't have to worry about being polite, and which we all should be, right?
Mm-hmm.
But white people are not telling their sons, when you get stopped, don't move. Keep your hands on the steering wheel. Roll your window down. We see over and over on all social media platforms, Harold, where our white brothers get stopped, and the experience is completely, completely different than ours.
Yeah.
The tone, their posture, their demeanor, their level of disrespect for law enforcement. And then in closing, my brother and I were just conversing in the car. And what we realized is we already know this has been going on in America forever. the truth of the matter is now everyone has a cell phone.
Yeah.
So now yeah. it's being captured. That's why black people in America, we're not shocked when we see these horrific acts being committed on African-Americans and men of color.
Well, Greg, thank you so much for your phone call. I appreciate it. Johnny, talk to me a little bit about what Greg just talked about. You said you've been out of policing for a while, but you are still a product of a modern, high-profile police department. Before you left, what kind of discussions about cultural competency, race, profiling, and the like were being had? What kind of training, if any, was being implemented?
Harold, that's a great question. And, you know, also, even though it's been a few years since I've been retired, I still educate public safety and law enforcement leaders across the country in a couple of different academic programs at universities. But I will tell you that, you know, we have training on, you know, on all kinds of levels. And one of the ones that is very specific is has to do with, you know, public trust and legitimacy. And in this particular training that we were doing probably about 4 or 5 years ago, maybe a little longer, what emerged from that training was initially it was outward focused to create, you know, better legitimacy in policing through procedural justice, principal policing practices, you know, things having to do with evidence-based policing techniques and having listening sessions. And these were supposed to be outward facing. But what we discovered within the organization, we didn't have trust. And if you look across research, there's Pew Research that actually shows that black and white officers or officers of color versus white officers do not see race and equity the same on how it's being, you know, given out to the public or even how it is seen inside the organization. So you already have this fracturing, but yet you want our police officers to go out and provide, you know, a service together in unity. And so those are some of the trainings that, you know, we found were very eye-opening to the work that needs to be done internal to the organization and to the people that make up the organization, is to understand that there is a place, again, for this emotional intelligence type of work. There's layers of leadership in the organization where there are failures or inadequacies or what I often call mediocrity, where a lot of the accountability and responsibility to actually take action to hold people accountable through disciplinary processes weren't taking place. And so policing has generally been metrics driven, but we started moving to being more not performance metric driven, but interaction driven with the community through different activities. And that was a huge change for our organization when we've been very, very metric driven for decades. Because that is how you are assessed by, you know, the governor who oversees the whole department, by the communities in California in which you serve, which how your funding is received. But that was a big shift,
yeah.
Was looking at things differently. And law enforcement needs to do more of that.
Let me go back to the phone lines, 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. G calling from D.C. Thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Hey, Harold.
Hey, how are you?
I was just listening to y'all, and I was just listening to the comment earlier that the lady was saying that her husband and her are police officers and that she, you know, talked to her kids and everything. Of course, Harold, if you talk to the police and one of their kids gets stopped, and you tell them that your mom and your dad are police officer, of course they're not going to do nothing to them. Let me tell you one thing that I had. This was last week, Earl.
Keep it real quick because I've got a lot of folks on the line.
Okay.
Go right ahead.
And then another thing I just want to suggest, that's not so. When we get pulled over here by the police officer, they're already on aggressive mode. They already come to you with an attack. So that make the other person, which is the black person, get kind of aggressive and say, well, okay then, sir, what you stop me for? What did I do? And they'll get aggressive. So it'd be good for anybody to pull people in a light area so everybody can see, so they can use their cameras and they can film them, because that's not so.
Okay.
If you get pulled over by the police, somebody need to be around, because if you don't, they're going to beat you up, they're going to talk disrespectful to you, and they're going to make something up where as though you're going to get locked up.
Okay. Well, G, thank you so much. G makes an interesting point, Jeff. And I think this is something that we have seen. No, we did not see this in the case of the Army Lieutenant Caron Nazario. But if an officer has a tone that may be interpreted, I'm going to give them the benefit of the doubt in this scenario, that is interpreted as aggressive, disrespectful. I think the reality is, and I'd like for you to talk to me a little bit about this, and we're talking specifically about Black men. Issue of respect is a big thing with Black men. And whether it's a Black police officer, and certainly if it's a white police officer, if they feel that they are being disrespected, that can be problematic, Jeff.
It absolutely can be, but I also feel that kind of that perspective will lessen the argument on behalf of the person that's being victimized. It's kind of like officers, and correct me if I'm wrong, former assistant chief, officers are also trained in escalation tactics as well as de-escalation. And it's a psychological trip. I've been pulled over aggressively by police officers, and me knowing what I know, I stayed in a masterful disposition when it did happen. So what the caller is saying is correct, in that they come to the window aggressive. Literally, just real quick, I was driving up Georgia Avenue, headed from D.C., and I had the premonition I was going to get pulled over before I left my office. Sure enough, I crossed over to Silver Spring, two cops, three cars back. One of them pulls up behind me, hits the lights. And so naturally, like Assistant Chief was just saying, you pull over to the right. I attempted to pull over to the right. Guess what happens? The other police car revs up its engine and boxes me in. So if I hadn't went to the next lane, I would have hit their vehicle. And so I know right now they're attempting to make me nervous, to escalate. Like she said, what did you say? Assertive movement creates suspicion. And so this is a tactic. I'm totally aware that they're trying to make me nervous so that they can take this as far as they would need to and want to. So what I did, and the only other option I had, was to turn down this little side street, like the caller just said. I'm not going down no dark street. I'm staying where it's well lit. You're going to make me pull over on this median on Georgia Avenue? Have at it. I'll make sure I can protect you as much as possible. I'll stop on this median. I pulled over to the left to the median. One young Black officer comes to my driver's side, and like Assistant Chief said, if there's two of them, they come in both sides. I rolled both of my windows all the way down. I turned on my interior light because it's nighttime.
Mm-hmm.
Hands at 10 and 2 on the wheel. Turn my interior light. And when I drive around, I have my license literally tucked into one of the creases on the dashboard because I'm not going in my pocket. Why? Because I'm mastering this situation. And if it does jump off, you would never be able to say it was because of me. And so long story short, they come up and I'm looking to say, hey, officer, how you doing tonight? Like you say, personalizing. How you been, man? Okay, having a good shift? So although they came aggressive, I'm immediately in de-escalation mode. Why? Because I'm responsible for my survival, and I'm not going to depend on his whims and how he's feeling tonight. I'm changing everything up. His partner comes up. I look over at him. Hey, man, how you doing? Oh, I'm fine. Hey, pretty good night out here tonight. I said, yes, it is. How can I help y'all? Because I'm not getting set up. Whatever they thought they were doing, it wasn't happening. So at the end of the night, here's what happens. I didn't get a ticket. I got sent on my merry little way. But here's what I understood.
Why were you stopped?
That's a good point. Because I had a trim around my back license plate. That's what they said. You know what was really going on? They were training their rookies how to hunt, and they were out there hunting that night. And I don't know if people have ever experienced this. When you're driving down the street and you get pulled over with a speed trap, it's like they're hunting. If they're standing out there with the gun pointed, that's one of the scariest sensations I've ever had, a man standing in the street pointing a gun at your car, even if it's a radar gun. They were hunting that night, Harold.
Yeah.
They were hunting, and I disarmed them.
Yeah, Johnny, tell me about why... And this may be a training thing. This may be, interpretation. I don't know. Why is it that some officers may approach you in a way, let's say speeding, a traffic stop, some ways that are more aggressive than others? Is that a personality thing? What's going on there?
So I'm glad you added the last part. A lot of times it can be very much a personality thing because in, you know, for us in our academy, we train on professionalism. And so professionalism could be very much come across to, you know, a person as being stoic or unfriendly or unkind when they're like, good afternoon, good morning, ma'am or sir. The reason I stopped you, they're required to say this. The reason I stopped you is because you're speeding at 70. The speed limit is 55. I need to see your driver's license, registration, and insurance. And then when they get that, you know, they'll hear whatever it may be, and they go, I understand that, sir. I'll be right back. I'm going to go and write you a ticket. They go back. They write a ticket. They come back, and they're like, I need your signature here. This is where you'll find your court information. And then they give them the copy of their ticket, and they're also supposed to help them safely enter back into the roadway, like make sure you check your mirror. You might want to build up your speed here on the shoulder and be careful when you enter traffic. That is generally what a traffic stop is supposed to look like. That is what they are trained to do. But you will get individual officers who do have personality issues. They, you know, maybe have had a bad day. I don't know their situation. But that is not a common practice for officers to be overly aggressive and to treat people aggressively. Now, they do get, you know, they're hyper-vigilant all the time. They're constantly, the adrenaline is pumping when they're on a stop. They're going call to call. And so, you know, they get out there and they get involved and get engaged. And that's where this intervening, where policy is being changed, many agencies have it, where your partner officer or other officers that are responding should be able to take that step back from the primary officer who's making the contact and be able to help them de-escalate themselves, maybe take a step back and have a better assessment of what they need to do. But oftentimes that is not happening. And this is where we want to see this grow in policing culture, is for other officers who are at these incidents to take a leadership role, step up and say, you know what? I need you to step back, Officer Bob. I've got this right now. I'm going to go ahead and talk to the citizen, okay? You go ahead and go over there. I've got this. Watch me from over there, but I've got this. But our officers need to start having a voice and being able to control some things and having the courage to do that in the moments that they're happening, not later when they talk about it like what I would have done. Mm-hmm. It's what they should have done.
Let me go back to the phone lines. Tarek calling from D.C. Thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Hello, how you doing?
Tariq.
Okay, yeah, Tariq. Sorry, either one.
Yeah.
Doesn't matter.
But, no, I want to get it right. Tariq, go right ahead, man. What's on your mind?
But, yeah, this is a good conversation. I mean, because the issue that we're taking with policing is we're not dealing with human beings in the situation. Mm-hmm. Because the reality is every city is different. I grew up in New York. I went to college in Boston, lived up in Boston, and then I came down to D.C., Maryland area. And policing here is definitely different than it is in Boston. I didn't feel the same way because, you know, you have officers that are familiar with the people in the community and from the community. And when people from outside of the community come in and become an officer, they actually kind of check them. And so to keep them in check. But in Boston, you have it where there were certain sections I couldn't go to in the 80s. I'm 56. And so, you know, South Boston I couldn't go to. And you have the officer from Southie that has that same attitude that he's not letting us in his neighborhood, so he's in control when he pulls me over. You know, I don't give him any promise because I know the type of individual that's stopping me.
And let me just say, Boston and Southie, it's just not about the police. Okay, let's be clear that you know there are those invisible signs that people of color, you know, that's just not, you know, I mean, I get what you're saying. Historically, Boston was just not a place for people of color, but please make your point.
What I was saying was recruitment. When you recruit an officer, when you have an officer from South Boston and you have them over in Dorchester or Roxbury in a black section, and he's just dealing with black people, he has that same Southie attitude, and now he's an officer who has rules and regulations that he's supposed to follow, and he's not doing that. What it is that we're hiring individuals, and they're not going through that have issues, and then they're bringing their issues to the job, and they let that go on. I just saw something where they said that somebody was protesting. They said 95% of the officers are not from the city.
Right.
And somebody said they should cut the fund. I said, that makes no sense. Why don't you take that funding that $40 million and put it to recruitment for young people from the community so you can have people that are familiar with the community and know how to deal with it. They don't have this aggression. It's not a foreign thing. It's something that they deal with the black people every day, while other people, the only time they ever deal with them is when they come in and they're pulling them over.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
And one thing I just wanted to say
real quick, because I got another call. Go ahead.
Okay, real quick. When I get pulled over, I never, ever let an officer end up becoming a judge or the prosecutor. No problem. What you need? What? Okay, I'm this and that. Thank you very much. And I'll see you in court, and I'll have a judge and a prosecutor. Then we'll deal. Then you'll see me. But what happens is we actually let them be the judge, the prosecutor, and the jury, and you're gonna be at a loss when you start arguing with them, especially when you know they're aggressive. Just leave it alone.
Tariq, thank you so much. Emmanuel, calling from D.C. Quickly, what's on your mind?
Yes, sir. I just have a comment. I'd like to say good evening to you and to all the listeners.
Yes, sir.
This is politics, not politics. This starts at Capitol Hill. If these police would be held accountable for their actions, they would stop this. If Chauvin, who killed George Floyd, knew he would get 20 to 25 years for putting his knee on that man's neck, he wouldn't have did that. That's all I had to say, sir.
Okay, Manuel, thank you so much. I do... Jeff, you were going to say something before I took a call. Go ahead and make a point.
It was in response to something that the assistant chief had said, and I kind of lost the thought at this point listening to our callers, man. It's just, I just want us to be very, very clear that I feel that the training that officers are receiving is insufficient for the level of work that they have to do. We can't handle officers with kid gloves. We make a lot of excuses. Not saying the assistant chief is doing that or anybody on this call. But we're forced to have a certain level of understanding about how difficult the job is and how, you know, they never know what's going to happen when they approach the vehicle and these things of this nature. There is training out here to help somebody to get under emotional control. I mean, I don't know if we need to institute some deep meditation processes for people who are going into law enforcement and firefighters, anything that's very intense. Because as Assistant Chief said, you know, adrenaline is pumping. But, you know, you can learn techniques to control your adrenaline and to control how it impacts your behavior and your attitude. And I just don't think that people are doing it. And another very important part of this conversation that's not really being had at this point is that sometimes people who are racist seek out to become law enforcement intentionally, and they get in there. There's no amount of professional training that's going to curtail that racist desire that they have. And the power that they get to act it out with impunity.
You know, it's interesting say that because there's been a big conversation about that since January 6th. And the police officers who have been arrested and implicated in the U.S. Capitol insurrection from around the country. And that has raised a lot of questions. But, Johnny, go right ahead, please.
Yeah, I was just going to say, you know, you're absolutely right, Jeff, that this has been a conversation that, you know, there is not a national standard in our United States of America for policing practices and policing training. And I know that places like International Association of Chiefs of Police are trying to create some standardized guidelines. We have legislation that's trying to do that for the very things that you're talking about on what are we training our officers. They do need to have some officer safety tactics, understand constitutional policing, but there also needs to be a better body of training around, you know, emotional intelligence, mindfulness practices, you know, informed trauma care. You know, when you're dealing with people from communities that are suffering trauma and knowing how to interact, as well as, you know, how to deal with, you know, mental health crisis as we're seeing.
Right.
But I do want to say that there are changes that are happening. I want to highlight those that you are seeing in our country where police chiefs are firing negligent employees immediately for the work that they're doing. You are seeing that prosecutors and DAs are taking the charges forward. There is legislation that is, you know, trying to modify or remove things like qualified immunity and Peace Officers Bill of Rights, which that will not be popular for me to say with my law enforcement people listening. But what we need to know is the qualified immunity and the Police Officer Bill of Rights, which are protections while they do their job or when they're involved in internal investigations, these things do need to be looked at so that they can be fairly assessed in order to provide the confidence, the trust, the transparency, and the outcomes that need to happen when you have bad police officers who are doing things that are killing and harming other people. They can no longer be protective measures that create this elongated process that does what? It paints every other police officer in that same light, and they are not those people, so they should not defend that for that reason. But these things are starting to change because of everybody who's listening to you on this call. They are having a voice. Everybody that is stepping out and is, you know, asserting their First Amendment rights, it's creating change. It's creating change in training.
Yeah. So it's not happening quick enough. You know, I mean, it's happening. It's gradual. And, yes, I know it's coming. But, you know, people are dying. And people are feeling that justice is not being served.
Well, there has been.
When the lieutenant was pulled over, the younger officer, in line with what you were saying, Assistant Chief, about other officers stepping in, you can tell that the younger officer, the one that was being recorded, he was trying to come. He's like, hey, man, just get out the car, because he noticed his partner was escalating unnecessarily.
Yeah.
And it seemed like he had more reasoning than the older officer was being super and unnecessarily aggressive.
Well, Johnny, I wanted to, just for your own edification, just this past week, the Maryland legislature overrode a veto of that the governor had signed relating to police reform. The Maryland state legislature has passed sweeping police reforms. I mean, a laundry list of things, including dealing with the police Bill of Rights. I certainly invite you to look at it. There's just so much information that has come out about that very thing this week. But I did want to ask you two things before we run out of time. The first thing is it appropriate for a passenger in a traffic stop to ask an officer, why did you stop me, if they're telling you to get out of the car, as we saw in the Army lieutenant situation? He kept asking, why are you stopping me? What's going on? Somebody tell me something. And no one was telling him anything. Your thoughts about that? And secondly, before he was shot, and I know there's this big fight or flight feeling for a lot of people of color, talk to me about the Dante Wright thing. From your position as a former officer, what went wrong there? First of all, the questioning of the officer, and secondly, that video in the Minnesota case.
So the one with the lieutenant, the second lieutenant from the U.S. Armed Forces, that particular stop should have went completely differently. I watch these sometimes, and I'm absolutely baffled. I don't understand. For one, they're making a stop based on the tags, but yet he has the temporary in the window. So when you approach him, there should be no reason for one to take him out of the car. So let me just go ahead and say that. It would be, you're telling him the reason for the stop. I need to confirm your registration. I see you have a temporary tag. I need your license and your registration and insurance, and take a look at that. That seemed to turn into something I cannot explain to you, because that should have never happened at all, period. With Dante Wright, that particular, incident, again, I don't want to sit here on Monday morning quarterback that, but there are police tactics in that particular stop that if would have been done differently and more appropriately, that outcome could have been very different.
Such as?
But for one, when they know that they have a warrant on a suspect after they've run the plate or the driver's license, oftentimes, what will happen is you don't say that. You may tell your partner officer, but you don't necessarily let the driver know, because now they know that you know. So you would go and say, Mr. Wright, if you don't mind, we'd like you to step out of the car for a minute. We need to talk to you over here. Just bring your driver's license with you. And you take them, normally you take them to, the right front of your patrol car, which would be behind their vehicle. And you'd have a conversation to say, we have here your one for a warrant. Whatever the warrant may be, maybe you can cuff them before, but it depends on what the warrant is for. I mean, this is where the, common sense and judgment and critical thinking comes in with policing, to be able to look at a situation and assess it and make the right decision, because you have a lot of discretion when you are out there affecting an arrest or making a contact. But they didn't. Instead, it was the proximity of the officer as he, you know, already given him a search. She comes up. They're talking about a warrant. All of a sudden, he tightens his control hold, and it looks like all of a sudden now Mr. Wright is extremely scared, right? What's about to happen? And like you said, the fight or flight comes in. And then it just becomes messy after that. That's all I can say is it just becomes terribly tragic and messy when it could have looked a lot differently.
Yeah. Jeff, I'll let you have a final word on the psychology of dealing with police and making sure that you do get home alive.
Yeah. Mr. Neely Fuller Jr. talks about the three F's. He said, don't fuss, don't fight, and don't flee. And I believe that that's sound advice coming from a wise 91-year-old elder who's seen a lot in this world. He's a retired military officer. And when you look at the three F's, don't fuss, don't fight, don't flee, basically it's saying don't escalate an already potentially bad situation. Don't have too much pride, you know, to where don't have so much pride to where you have to feel like you need to argue your case right there. You won't win. And that's just the hands down. You will not win. And as a caller said earlier, the white kids, they could get disrespectful and rude. They're a protected class of people. Right, we don't have those same privileges. Hashtag the rules different. And so do whatever you got to do to maintain your own emotional level. You know, stay calm as much as possible. Talk to the officer. Don't be rude. Don't escalate. And again, I hear y'all, it ain't up to the civilian, but it is in many cases. You're the number one person responsible for your survival. Don't leave it up to this officer who might be questionable coming up. Be respectful. Take care of yourself. Get home. Survive the encounter, whatever the cost.
Yeah. Dr. Jeff Menzies and Johnny Reddick, thank you both for talking to us. I appreciate your input.
Hey, thank you.
Absolutely. Thank you, Harold.
That is the Daily Drum on Sirius XM Channel 141 for this Tuesday, April 13th. I'm Harold Fisher. Now, stay tuned for Unheard with Wes Hall. Good night.